The buried evidence. In February of 2020, a block of ancient ice surrendered its secret. As the Polis Glacier on Argentina's Mount Aconcagua receded, it spat out a battered camera, still marked in blue tape, with the name Janet Johnson and her Denver address. Inside, the film had survived nearly 50 years. And when the 24 images were developed, they revealed something chilling. A cheerful, composed Janet posing with fellow climbers just hours before she died. Her face unmarked, her eyes clear. It was more than a time capsule. It was a clue. Janet Johnson had joined John Cooper and six other Americans in January 1973 to attempt the Polis Route, one of the mountain's most treacherous climbs. The group, organized by Oregon's Mazales Climbing Club, was eclectic. A lawyer, a psychiatrist, a police officer, a college student, the teacher, and the NASA engineer. They set out with high spirits, but by the time they reached 20,000 feet, illness and fraying tempers had split the party in half. Only four pressed higher into the thin air. Johnson was among the strongest. She'd already conquered every 14,000-foot peak in Colorado, a feat only a handful of women had achieved. Cooper, breaking in his boots during shifts at Mission Control, guiding the lunar modules of the Apollo missions, carried the quiet aura of a man who had watched humans walk on the moon. Yet in Aconcagua, neither experience nor composure would matter. Of the four members who attempted a final push to the summit, Johnson and Cooper never returned. Their companions offered strange, conflicting accounts of what happened. They claimed Cooper turned back first, descending alone. He never reached camp. Days later, his body was found frozen into the glacier, his face locked in an expression of terror. An autopsy revealed not just hypothermia and head injuries, but a round wound from his abdomen deep to his spine, an injury no fall could explain. Johnson's end was stranger still. Teammates claimed they found her collapsed in the snow, whispering that she wanted to be left to die. They tried to drag her down by rope, but in their own accounts, blurred by hallucinations and phantom voices, they lost her. When Argentine climbers finally recovered her body in 1975, they recoiled. Her jacket was bloodstained. Her face bore three deep wounds. A rock had been placed upon her chest, as if to pin her down in the middle of the ice. Her left arm, still wearing a watch, would be found nearby, along with her camera, in 2020. For decades, the deaths were written off as accidents of altitude and exhaustion. But the injuries seemed to tell another story. Doctors present at the autopsy suspected foul play. Now, with the photos unearthed by a warming planet, new questions have surfaced about Johnson's last moments. The images show no signs of altitude sickness. Her face is focused, her framing deliberate. They were taken the night before she died. So how did she fall? Why was she found so far from shelter? Why did the surviving climbers, all of whom returned to the U.S. without extensive questioning or charges, hold a secret debriefing meeting and never speak publicly again? The last photo remains. Janet, mid-smile, staring up the slope of Aconcagua. Not a snapshot of triumph, a warning, maybe. A breadcrumb left behind by a woman who, half a century later, might still be trying to tell us what happened on the mountain. The Chivriwaya Pass photo. A grainy photograph shows 10 young skiers smiling into the Arctic dust. Hours later, every one of them would be dead. scattered across the ice in ways that defy explanation. Their tragedy would echo the Dyatlov Pass mystery. Sealed coffins, rumors of radiation burns and missing eyes, an unexplained 11th pair of skis, and KGB files locked away for decades. In January of 1973, a group of adventurous students from Kuybyshev set off into the barren wilderness of Russia's Kola Peninsula. The skiers, aged 17 to 26, were well prepared, experienced, and eager to glimpse the northern lights. But their final photograph, taken at twilight just before ascending the Chevrouai Pass, has haunted investigators ever since. Hours after this snapshot, all 10 would be dead, scattered inexplicably across the frozen tundra. What happened after that final fateful photo is uncertain, but we know the weather turned savage. Temperatures plunged to minus 19 degrees Fahrenheit, with wind gusts reaching an unfathomable 110 miles per hour. Villagers in nearby Revda later recalled that the storm was so fierce that it blew roofs off houses, calling it, quote, "the night the dogs flew." Days later, another group stumbled upon a macabre sight atop the icy plateau, a frozen hand protruding from a snowbank, clutching desperately at the shredded remains of a tent. It belonged to the group's leader, Mikhail Kuznetsov, who died trying to anchor the shelter against the hurricane-force wind. On top of the collapsed tent lay four more victims, apparently unable to secure it in the gale. Even more troubling was what searchers found next. The other five skiers had vanished into the storm, their bodies scattered far from the tent. Two were discovered months later beneath the cliff, their watches frozen at precisely 5 a.m. Another body was discovered as the snow began to melt, his wristwatch frozen at 4:33 a.m. But when rescuers counted the equipment, they made a strange discovery. 10 skiers, but 11 pairs of skis. Stranger still were the whispers from relatives who claimed the corpses bore orange-red discolorations like radiation burns, and in some cases, missing eyes. Those details were quickly hidden away in sealed coffins. Yet forensic experts later noted the stains weren't signs of fallout at all, but a well-known marker of death by freezing. Frost arrhythmia, the eerie red bloom left by the cold itself. What truly drove these young hikers apart, forcing them into the Arctic abyss alone? Officially, hypothermia was claimed. Yet even the rescuers, seasoned mountaineers, were baffled. They noted bizarre footprints scattered randomly, vanishing without explanation. Theories ranged wildly, from secret military weather experiments to a strange Arctic madness known as Meryachenia, causing sufferers to hallucinate and wander blindly into death. But the haunting final photograph, capturing 10 bright-eyed adventurers standing united at the gateway to their doom, remains mute. 50 years later, it still asks a question no one can answer. What did these skiers see or sense in that last moment of clarity, just before the Arctic night swallowed them whole? The Dead Horse Camp photo. The last photograph of explorer Percy Fawcett feels more like a warning than a portrait. Fawcett wasn't just seeking gold or glory. He was hunting Zed, a city he described as older than Egypt, with pyramidal temples, stone roads, and rooms that glowed with a light no one could explain. Taken in late May 1925 at a place called Dead Horse Camp, it's the last image of them alive. Hours later, Fawcett dispatched a letter to his wife, Nina. Its tone was unsettlingly calm, quote, "You need have no fear of any failure." His last words home were strangely confident. Fawcett's life had been a steady march toward this moment. He was a soldier, a spy in Morocco, a war hero, decorated with Britain's Distinguished Service Order, and a friend of Arthur Conan Doyle, who used Fawcett's field reports of monsters on the margins of the map to conjure the lost world. Fawcett claimed to have seen a 60-foot anaconda, a venomous spider the size of a dog, even two-nosed hunting hounds, and living dinosaurs. His adventures already blurred the line between science and horror. Yet none of it gripped him like the thought of Zed, which he believed to be buried deep in the jungles of Mato Grosso, Brazil. He clutched a 1753 Portuguese manuscript that described arches, temples, and monumental statues. A vanished metropolis erased by the forest. In letters to his son, Brian, he painted Zed as a place of pyramidal temples, stone roadways, and strangest of all, rooms lit by a strange source of light that terrified the Indians. He traveled light for his final attempt. Just three men, including his oldest son, Jack, a sextant, a chronometer, and a few cases of supplies. Stealth over strength. In his pocket, he carried a 10-inch tall idol made of basalt, which he believed would command him respect from the jungle's tribes. And he left strict orders, if he disappeared, to not come looking for him. In his final letters from Dead Horse Camp, he provided two different sets of coordinates for his location. Was it a mistake, or a two-degree lie, deliberate or desperate, meant to throw off anyone who tried to follow? What happened after the photograph is stitched together only by fragments. The Kalapalo people remember the three men passing through, sick and limping. They warned them not to continue eastward into the land of the fierce Indians. For five nights, they saw smoke from the explorers' fires. On the sixth night, nothing. Five fires, then darkness. The trail that followed was littered with relics. A brass nameplate in 1927, a theodolite surveying instrument in 1933, his signet ring surfacing in a Colobar pawn shop in 1979. His ring came back. He didn't. Bones were once presented as his, but they proved false. Even the bones lied. Rescue attempts spiraled into obsession. Rumors claimed up to 100 seekers died chasing him. The jungle kept the searchers too. Yet today, archaeology confirms that vast garden cities and road grids once flourished in the Mato Grosso. Zed might not be myth. But it is that last photograph that lingers. Three men at the edge of the world, their eyes fixed, not on the camera, but on something else. Something waiting in the trees. The Newlyweds. Frozen in black and white, Glenn and Bessie Hyde sit stiffly aboard their homemade boat. A 20-foot wooden scow named Rain in the Face, adrift somewhere deep inside the Grand Canyon in 1928. Glenn's jaw is clenched. Bessie, just 22, looks straight into the camera with a face too serious for a honeymoon. Behind them, the canyon walls loom like closing jaws. That photo, developed from a camera found weeks later in their abandoned boat, is their haunting final image. Glenn, an Idaho farmer with river experience, and Bessie, an aspiring poet new to the wilderness, set off on a honeymoon adventure down the treacherous Colorado River. The journey was daring. Had they succeeded, Bessie would become the first woman to navigate the canyon's deadly rapids. The Hydes launched in October, hoping to ride the treacherous waters to Needles, California. A few weeks in, they climbed the Bright Angel Trail to resupply, posed for photos at photographer Emery Kolb's studio on the South Rim, then descended once more into the shadows. On November 18th, they passed below Hermit Rapid and were never seen again. The search was exhaustive, but chillingly fruitless. A search plane eventually discovered their scow, drifting silently downstream on December 19th. Rescuers would find it fully stocked with gear, food, and even Bessie's journal. The last entry, a casual note about navigating the violent 231-mile rapid. The boat seemed untouched, as though the river had simply reached up and plucked them away. Did they capsize in the brutal rapids 1 mile further downstream, where jagged granite slabs lurked beneath the surface like submerged fangs. Did they attempt to hike out and perish on the unforgiving cliffs? Or, more disturbingly, did one of them turn on the other? Then came the stories. In 1971, around a campfire on a rafting trip, an old woman claimed she was Bessie Hyde. She said Glenn had been abusive. One night, she stabbed him, hiked to Pete Springs, and disappeared into a new life. She later recanted, but by then, the myth had taken root. In 1992, famed Grand Canyon River running guide Georgie Clark died. Among her belongings, a pistol, mysterious documents, and a marriage license for one Bessie DeRoss. Some believed she was Bessie, living incognito for decades. But the timelines didn't quite match. And in 1976, a bullet-riddled skull was found in a garage on Emery Kolb's property. Had Kolb killed them? The remains, it turned out, belonged to someone else entirely from 1933. River historian Brad Demock retraced their journey in a replica scow, suffering bruises and terror on the same waters. He concluded they likely perished in the rapids. To this day, under a canyon moon, boatmen still tell the story. The last photo of Glenn and Bessie, still archived in Flagstaff. Look closely, and you'll see it. They're not smiling. They're staring into something only they could see. The Stranded Kayaker. The last known image of Andrew McCauley is the kind that stays with you. Grainy, ghostly pale from exhaustion, his eyes hollow and staring somewhere beyond the lens. This was no ordinary photograph, no proud selfie snapped at the climax of victory, but a chilling portrait of a man teetering on the edge. Within hours, he would vanish into the cold, relentless embrace of the Tasman Sea. In early 2007, Andrew McCauley set out alone from Tasmania, determined to become the first person to paddle nearly 1,000 miles across the Tasman to New Zealand. McCauley, a veteran adventurer, and recipient of Australian Geographic's Adventurer of the Year Award, was meticulous. He modified his kayak with a custom-built fiberglass canopy named Casper, a crude, smiling dome designed to shield him from storms and waves that rose higher than houses. But the Tasman Sea, notorious for rogue waves and sudden storms, was not easily impressed. Midway through his journey, McCauley endured a hellish 28-hour tempest, locked inside Casper. He recorded the terror, 30-foot waves pitching him upside down, riding again in violent repetition. Yet he didn't press the emergency beacon inches from his fingertips. Instead, he waited the storm out, sending an understated text afterward, quote, "No picnic today." By early February, McCauley had nearly done it. The jagged peaks of New Zealand's South Island rose on the horizon. His wife Vicky and their 3-year-old son Finley were waiting in Milford Sound, where fellow paddlers had gathered with ginger beer and whiskey. On February 8th, Andrew sent a jubilant message, quote, "See you 9 a.m. Sunday." But the danger wasn't behind him yet. Just 30 miles from shore, he made a garbled distress call, quote, "I need a rescue," he gasped, panic edging into his voice. "My kayak's sinking. I fell off. I'm going down." The message was so fragmented that rescue officials initially dismissed it as a cruel prank. But reality was grim. The kayak was discovered drifting upright, its eerie, smiley-faced canopy missing. Yet strangely, inside remained his paddle, satellite phone, GPS, and the emergency beacon he refused to activate. McCauley was simply gone. Investigators speculate he capsized without Casper's protective dome. Weak and hypothermic, he would have struggled desperately to re-enter his kayak. In that moment, perhaps Andrew glanced at the photograph taped to the deck in front of him. his smiling 3-year-old son, Finley, waiting just a few heartbreaking miles away. It's hard to imagine a more haunting end. A father alone in an empty ocean, reaching helplessly as his vessel drifted away. Andrew McCauley understood the razor-thin line between courage and madness. Critics called his journey selfish, reckless. Yet, had he paddled those final miles, we'd celebrate him as an icon. What's the biggest red flag across all 5 mysteries? One detail that won't leave your head. Let me know in the comments. As always, thank you for watching Dark 5. Like and subscribe to continue exploring the greatest mysteries of this world and beyond.